Silas mopped the sweat off his face with the edge of his blankets. The bed was moist beneath him, and there was the unmistakable ammonia stink of urine mixed with the sweat. Damn it. The dream was killing him. He awoke feeling weaker at every dawn. Another slice of his sanity gone forever. Back at El Morro in San Juan, the scientist had believed he held the key to control jumps through the redoubts, and had attempted to go backward through time to slay Tanner. At least he thought that was why he wanted to go back. He assumed there had been good reasons for the gamble, but they were gone, along with most of his memory. At first, Silas thought he had jumped back to the late 1800s of Vermont, but it became clear rather quickly that he had become mired in a jump nightmare, one that would leave him for a few months, and then return in shocking clarity. First, no more than once a month, then once a week. Now, three or four times a week. Soon it would be every night, and after that, who knew? Perhaps it would start claiming him during the day, and his brilliant mind would be gone forever, trapped in an endless fantasy of his own creation. From somewhere deep in his childhood, the words, "As ye sow, so shall ye reap," came unbidden to his mind. Silas shook off the religious nonsense. The dream was merely a forced feedback loop from the electromagnetic field of the Mantrans chambers, probably augmented by his proximity to the high-voltage transformers of the dish. Yes, of course, that was the answer. Once the great project was finished and the kite was operational, he could leave Tennessee and be free from the dream forever.
If I don't go mad first.
Sir?
Nothing important, Major.
Silas wanted to leave the bed and wash, but that would have to wait until the sec chief departed. A wave of shame tightened his chest, and he forced it away by sheer force of will.
Has there been any word on Tanner and the others?
Sheffield scowled.
Nothing for over a week, sir. They left Front Royal in a repaired LAV-25 and disappeared. But we have sec men watching every drivable road from the north, south, and east, with landmines and traps on all major bridges. Ryan will never reach Tennessee alive.
Rubbing his sore leg, Dr. Silas Jamevu stared at the eager young officer sitting rigidly on the small chair. The man was so strong and proud. His blue uniform was spotless, his blasters glistening with oil, boots polished like a mirror.
That's what Overton said once.
But I'm not playing politics with Cawder. Believe me, as long as they keep to the roads, I'll present you with their heads on a silver plate in only a matter of days, maybe less.
Perhaps. But isn't the Bradley Light Armored Vehicle Piranha Class Model 25 amphibious? Isn't the transport also designed to be used as a boat?
The sick man was confused.
Is it, sir?
Well, I think we had better find out very quickly.
A stingwing darted from the rushes along the basin. Standing on the shore, the gentle waves lapping around his combat boots, Ryan saw the movement out of the corner of his eye. He drew his Sig Sauer and fired. The silenced 9mm blaster coughed, and the winged muti exploded in midair, bloody feathers tumbling down onto the beach. There was a disturbance under the sand, and blue-shelled crabs rose into view like ghosts from a grave. They climbed over the tiny corpse, tearing the muti apart with their sharp pincers and stuffing their mouths full. One large azure crab had a dozen tiny copies on its back and passed morsels of the stingwing over its quivering antennae to the clicking brood. A gray dawn was beginning to break in the fiery sky, and Ryan stood guard over the others as they finished conveying the last of the fresh water and ammo onto the bobbing rafts. Stout ropes moored the crude craft to the stump of a dead tree, a gentle current tugging them away from the shore. There had been enough logs from the felled trees to build a dozen rafts, but the companions decided on just two. Lashed together with ropes and chains, the first was small, only 10 feet squared. Three of the inflated tires from the LAV bolted to the belly of the craft. A small pile of ammo, food, and other supplies lay in the middle of the raft. A sheet of canvas covered the goods, and multiple ropes secured the cargo. A tiller made from a door off an ammo locker was at one end, tight between two upright stanchions. J.B. was dubious of the arrangement, but Ryan had assured the man it would work fine. The second raft was much bigger, 30 feet squared, with four piles of supplies set between the tires, bolted underwater at each corner. This kept the center clear, helped to balance the craft, and gave the companion something to crouch behind in case of a fight. Another door served as a tiller. The bobbing craft were attached to each other with stout metal chains, which would keep them together through riptides or fog. But in case of emergency, they could cut the larger raft loose to block pursuit, and shoot the ammo boxes on board to eliminate their pursuers. The end of the logs were ragged and full of splinters, and the companions had done nothing to change that. The wild array of jagged kindling made a very good defense against unwanted passengers, man or mutie, climbing on board. Ryan studied the rafts with a critical gaze. Tree trunks with the bark still on, old rope, rusty chains, and a handful of nails. They didn't look like much, but hopefully they would last long enough to get them to Tennessee. Whistling a sea shanty, Doc was on the larger craft, testing the ropes holding down the canvas-covered piles. Jack stood on the other with his back to the shore, taking care of business.
Well, that's it for the supplies.
Christy waded to shore from the front raft. She stomped the Red River mud off her boots, sending the crabs scurrying away, dragging their breakfast along with them.
All the fuel's on board?
Yes.
Christy shook her head, her hair spreading out a corona of fiery glory to rival the coming dawn.
Food, blankets, all six of the rocket launchers. I'm surprised how much the raft could hold.
Just hope it's enough. Better wake Dean and Mildred and get going. We can each catch some more sleep once we're far from here.
I'll get them, lover.
Lend me a hand, Ryan.
JB was dragging a lumpy duffel bag toward the water.
What is it?
Ryan grabbed the rope and helped lift the bag off the ground.
Battery from the APC?
They waded into the cold water and splashed toward the nearer raft.
I'm gonna wire a headlight to the thing so we can see at night, scare a lot of folks, and save us a pile of killing.
With the morning breeze ruffling his silvery mane of long hair, Doc watched the two men approach from the second raft, his .44 Lamar held tight, the hammer cocked back and ready.
The halogen bulb will explode. Won't be able to take that much direct current.
I used different thicknesses of wires to cut the voltage so the headlight wouldn't blow. I can make it work. Shit!
JB shifted his balance, nearly going under as his boots slipped on a smooth rock.
Close call.
Ryan changed their direction away from the cargo raft.
Then we put this on the lead raft so we can see where we're going.
Sounds good.
Zipping his pants closed, Jack turned and gave the men a hand hauling the heavy bag over the ring of splinters. The teenager laced the bag to the ropes covering the canvas mound.
Good for fishing. Fish see light at night, come close. Spear all we want.
We never made any spears.
JB headed for the cargo raft. Jack jerked a thumb.
Doc has. Long ones.
You made spears?
Ryan climbed on board. He was dripping wet from the waist down, the water trickling down between the log deck and back into the basin.
Good thinking.
These are not spears, my dear Ryan, but poles for punting.
Doc was trimming small branches off a sapling with his pocket knife.
Barge poles.
The older man gave JB a boost on board. A thick piece of canvas draped over the splinters gave easy access to the deck of the homemade craft.
We can use them to push the raft along in case we get stuck on a sandbar.
Exactly.
Tilting the pole, Doc visually inspected the shaft, rotating it this way and that.
A bit off plumb, but nothing serious.
He tossed it onto the deck.
Punting.
Ryan changed into dry clothes and socks. He laid the wet garments on top of the canvas mound to let the sun dry them. Trimming another sapling, Doc shrugged.
It is an old English word, and I disremember its origin. Sorry.
Sliding on his boots, Ryan saw that Dean was walking backward along the shore, unraveling a greasy length of knotted rags from a slopping bucket. The other end of the line went through the top hatch of the LAV and down inside. Backpacks perched on their heads, Mildred and Christy were already wading across the basin, heading for different rafts. Once the boy played out the length to the end, he lit the end with a butane lighter. The shredded blankets began to burn fiercely, giving off huge volumes of greenish smoke, the fire crawling up the length very slowly. Dean waited a moment to make sure the fire had caught, then waded into the river. As soon as he was in the water, the crabs came out of hiding and began to finish the last few scraps of the dead stingwing, rooting in the sand for every tiny gobbet of flesh.
Hate to lose the wag.
Christy sighed as she changed her pants.